Hello, I'm Katie Copeland, editor and contributing writer of Encouragement for Motherhood, devotional writings on the work of Christ. Motherhood is a journey that shows us our limits, uncovers fears that we never knew existed, and reveals our profound need for grace. Through it all, the transformative work of Christ endures. Join me alongside voices like Gretchen Ronovic and Kelsey Klimbera as we explore the peace and assurance Christ offers us freely in our vocations as mothers. Secure your copy now at 1517.org/shop.
Welcome back to 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 podcast, network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the new things that we have. One of the new things we have is an academy by Bruce Hillman. You should sign up for the Church Fathers Academy. I think it's called the Early Church. And you can know things that your friends don't know. Your theological buddies that think they know stuff, well, they don't know some of this stuff. And so you could take that course.
I didn't know next much
time
of that,
you know.
Much of that stuff I didn't know.
Yeah. Right. I mean, let me tap into your sinful desires here. Do you want to like drop something on someone and then be like, wow, this guy probably knows everything. Go take this academy. It's free. And you can learn all about that early church. I recommend you do so. Also, of course, if you want to know how come that academy is free, how is it possible? It looks so good. It's so amazing. This can't possibly be free. Well, that's all because of donors. People like you supporting the work of 1517, so you can go over to 1517.org and go to the donate page or find a link in the show notes if you're listening on the old podcast, and you can become a supporter. It's real easy to do. Reoccurring donation, maybe a one-time large donation. We'll do either of those things. We'd love to have you help out. Of course, Eric wants to talk to you.
Oh, I do, Dan. Yeah, I'm Eric so eager. If you're a pastor or a leader in a church, I'm the guy to talk to about making your church an official church partner. 1517 too. You can reach me at erick@1517.org, and I'd love to talk about it with you.
All right. Well, you might have noticed because you jumped right in there. Who's that other voice? I don't know that voice. Who was it? See, Scott's like, I don't need an introduction. I'll just jump right in. We are joined in the new plan, as you know, for 30 minutes as we re-go through the New Testament, once again, is to have a guest on for every book. And so who did we get for one of the biggest, baddest books in the New Testament, the long book of Matthew? We just got the executive director, Scott Keith, so he's going to be with us for the duration. He might regret doing this, agreeing to it, but he's in
now. It's going to be a long road, Scott.
Well, and it's been interesting so far and get all the technology working.
It is. And so another thing, if you are listening to this on the podcast, if you want to check out, you may ask, what were all these one-off episodes? Why were you guys doing that? What took so long to get into doing what you guys regularly do? The answer is that we were launching a YouTube channel version, so a video version of 30 Minutes in the New Testament, which now, if you want, you can go watch us do this. Why you'd want to do that, I don't know, but some people like to do that. I don't know why you want to look at us three of us talk, but some people prefer it that way. The younger generation, that's how they do it. And so we're trying to reach as many people as possible in as many ways as possible, and this is one of the ways, and so we're doing it. So if that's you, if you were like this whole time like, I listen to the podcast, but man, I'd rather watch it. Well, we've got you over there. Just go to YouTube, type in 30 Minutes New Testament. You'll find it. You can subscribe, and you can do it.
Yeah, the actual channel, by the way, is @30MINNT.
That's not how anyone searches anything up on YouTube.
No.
But thanks.
This is true. It's the only way we can find it right now.
That's the only way you can find it?
I'll put a link in the show notes to that YouTube channel.
There you go.
You can find it. I'll put a link. You're going to find it. Okay, so as I said, we are going through Matthew once again, starting at the beginning of the New Testament. And what do we got, Eric? So the way this works is, it's been 7 years since we did Matthew. I mean, have we learned anything?
Well, that remains to be seen, but I can say at least a little bit about the introduction to the Gospel of Matthew. I mean, usually, you know, if you've followed us before, if you followed the podcast, you know we don't spend a ton of time going over all the introductory details because, frankly, there's a lot of it that is very speculative. If you read scholarship trying to date the Gospel of Matthew or something like that, you're going to get all sorts of different opinions. You know, the early church's sort of consensus about Matthew was that it was written in the 50s or 60s. That came from people like Papias and Irenaeus, who were real early sort of second-generation apostolic church fathers. It was also held at that time, and really for a good chunk of the church's history, that Matthew was the first gospel. That was sort of unanimous. I mean, there really wasn't any debate about that until really kind of the more modern historical critical method started to creep up in the 1800s. And then the consensus changed to suggest that Mark was the first one, the theory being his was the shortest, his doesn't include as much detail. Those who have more detail, like Matthew and Luke, used Mark, and then they built off of that, you know, some of their other memories and some of the, you know, subjects that they interviewed about the ministry and life of Jesus. For our purposes here, it doesn't really matter. I mean, this is just all kind of speculation.
Doesn't it feel like the opposite argument could also hold true? Where you'd be like, oh, Mark's shorter. Obviously, he was just like, man, these guys wrote too much. Let me condense this thing down to the real important stuff.
That would fit with Mark's whole sort of immediacy narrative. Sure.
It also, historical critical arguments always discount the work of the Holy Spirit and inspiration. And so they make assumptions that this is all working off of, you know, combined sources from other people and their flawed memory rather than sort of their memory in conjunction with the inspiration of the Spirit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's why a whole lot of modern scholars will say, well, Matthew couldn't have been written before 70 AD because he talks so much about the destruction of the temple. Yeah. Which shows us that he must have already known that the destruction of the temple happened. But again, that is the presupposition there, is that this is just all based on the memories of rando people from that time and not inspired by the Holy Spirit. So as far as the purpose of Matthew's writing, it's going to become abundantly clear as even we dive into the first chapter here, that Matthew is very much concerned with showing and proving that Jesus is indeed the Jewish Messiah, that he fits, that he fulfills all the prophecies. And so you're going to see Matthew reference the Old Testament constantly in making his case for that, sometimes even in ways that are kind of strange to us. You know, you'll see in the early chapters here, Matthew saying, as it says in Hosea or whatnot, mm-hmm. And you go, I don't think Hosea was talking about that particular thing that you're referencing. We'll explain all that. We'll try to make some sense out of that. But the point is, Matthew really does aim to show his fellow Jews that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. It does not mean that he says that exclusively. In fact, you know, even though there's sort of broad generalizations where, like, well, Luke wrote to a Greco-Roman audience and John writes to the world. The fact is, they all do this to one degree or another. It's just Matthew has a very Jewish emphasis in the way he writes his gospel.
Yeah, and, I mean, well, you're going to see like numerous times like Matthew will say things really trying to persuade his brethren, and he does what I would call he spreads some of the prophetic butter real thin, where you're like, whoa, like, okay. you know, when it says this, that's talking about this, and you're like, okay,
you're the authority here.
I guess so. I mean, I definitely wouldn't have put that together. Mm-hmm. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then I think maybe one other note to mention as you think about the purpose of Matthew is you're going to see him address how it is that the church can be the genuine people of God, this group of Jews and Gentiles together, all worshiping and submitting to the lordship of Christ. How does that all look? You're going to see a lot of parables in Matthew about the Israelites really at that time, Judah, really being replaced by the church, that the church is, in fact, where the true people of God are found. And therefore, it's no longer based on sort of any ethnic identity or any lineage, but it's based on faith alone. And the lineage there, if there's anything, is the faith of Abraham that we still have today.
Yeah. All right. Well, shall we get into it?
We should. Let's go ahead and dive in. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Well, right out the gate, what do you notice, fellas, in the first verse?
Well, I mean, you have the genealogy of Jesus Christ, who is the son of David, the son of Abraham. These are the two key figures for Matthew's audience. So, what do you got to do to be a Jew, and certainly to be the Jewish Messiah? Well, the first thing you got to do is be a son of Abraham. I mean, every Jew is a son of Abraham, right? I mean, certainly your Messiah is going to be a son of Abraham. I suppose you could have converted, but I don't think they thought that the Messiah was probably going to be a convert. He was going to be a son of Abraham. So he's saying, all right, Jesus is a son of Abraham. And there's this other little prophecy concerning the Messiah that's a pretty big key figure, like, you know, the guy that really, I think in the people's mind, if you're a Jew living at that time, the person you sort of most associate the Messiah with is not Abraham. That's where the Jewish people start, but it's David, right? Now, this is partially because you have the promise that the Messiah will be a son of David, right? I mean, there's going to, that they're waiting for someone to sit on David's throne forever. They're waiting for that. So this is going to be a son of David, and it's going to be someone like David. So in a lot of people's minds, the Messiah is just like David, but even better, which is really saying something, because in their mind, David is it.
Yeah, David is sort of peak Jewish nation.
Yes.
Yeah, most certainly. So right out the gate, we see that Jesus is, in fact, Jewish, and Jewish in all the ways that the prophecies made sure that the Messiah would have to be. Now we get into the genealogy. It says this: Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. Well, right out of the gate, we do notice in the genealogy of Jesus, and indeed he is connected to Abraham. Matthew shows this, and he does it all the way up to David. There's 14 generations here in this first set of genealogical names. But I think what many of us note when we read this genealogy is that this group of people that Jesus comes from is not a perfectly sanctified group of people.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you have here the mention of Rahab. You also have Boaz and Ruth, which is also a little bit, you're doing a little blood mingling going on there. I mean, you know, one thing that's funny is that I've thought about this before. When you're going through the genealogy, if you were a Jew at that time and you had like Rahab, right? So the Rahab the prostitute in the genealogy, you'd be like, that's a little scandalous. Like, you should like probably hide that. I wouldn't write that down. I wouldn't tell anyone that if you weren't asked. Maybe, I don't know what it'd be like having in your genealogy, but you know, it's something that is not desirable. But then they get to David, and they're like, yes, as if he's so much better than Rahab the prostitute. Like, that's so weird to me. You know, it's like, well, he's got Rahab in there, but he's got David too, though. So, like, that's probably cancels it out, right? And you're like, I don't know. Is David better than Rahab? I don't know if that's true.
I just think, too, that it reiterates what you said earlier, Dan, that kind of starts wide from Abraham and then just gets narrower, so that, you know, of course, that every person that considers himself a Jew is going to be descended of Abraham. But obviously after you get past Jacob, you have other options for the other tribes, and then start narrowing it down from there, from Judah
right
on down to David, to the important one, the important two, right? The son of Abraham, the son of David. And this just tells the story of how you get right there, and it doesn't pull any punches.
Yeah, yeah. No, the good thing about it is that Matthew is obviously not, you know, he's going to get up to Joseph, but Matthew is not trying to sterilize anything or edit anything out. Like there would be obvious edits that he might make if he was trying to make Jesus look cleaner than he was, yeah. Right? As far as lineage goes. Matthew's obviously not doing that. If you were like making the whole thing up, like you might do that. Like, why not? If you're just making up a religion, why not make it a little bit cleaner than that?
So we continue on in verse 6. It says, "And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Joram, and Joram the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon." So again, 14 more generations from David to the time of exile. I also want credit right now for being able to say all those names without stumbling even once. Thank you very much.
Do you think it's interesting that this translation calls it a deportation to Babylon? I think that's funny. It's almost like they didn't belong in the promised land, and they were deported to Babylon where they did belong. It's a weird translation of it. It's like usually called an exile.
It is weird. Because, I mean, what's the first thing that you think of when you hear deportation?
Like somebody came into a country that they didn't belong in and or that they weren't a citizen of, and they were removed back to their own country.
Yeah. We hear a lot of talk of deportation nowadays, and you're like, hey, we need to deport all these people or whatever. And you're like, which people? The people that came here that don't live here that, you know, now we're going to take them and put them back in the place where they came from. Yeah, that is interesting.
It probably definitionally works if you're to look up the strict definition of deportation. It's usually translated exile, which with the implication that they were removed from where they lived to somewhere else by force and weren't allowed to come back, which deportation doesn't necessarily get across in the way we use that word now.
Yeah, that it is interesting because and I suppose it is very fitting. Either word would fit for what the history of Israel was like. Because there was a sense in which even though they inhabited the promised land, they were constantly doing things to show why they didn't necessarily belong. They were constantly running after other gods. They were constantly doing all the things that God had warned them about before they took the promised land, that if they did it, they would eventually be booted out of the promised land. And that's exactly what happened when Babylon took them over. And they were gone for 70 years. I mean, we can sometimes read Bible history, you know, and kind of hear these big numbers and sort of squeeze it down and be like, oh, yeah, 70 years, not that much. That's two generations of people that, like, completely left their homeland. You know, like, we're completely detached from any sort of history and connection to the place that their ancestors had lived. So it was obviously a massive deal and really did change the shape and structure of Judaism for the rest of their history leading up to the first century when Jesus came around.
Yeah, the Greek is just to carry off. So, I mean, that's literally what deportation likely it's defined as. So I get why they did it. It's just exile gets across the fact that they were taken by force out of their home.
So we pick it up at verse 12. And after the deportation of Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abiud, and Abiud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Achim, and Achim the father of Eliud, and Eliud the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Mathan, and Mathan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. Now, again, as you noted, Scott, there's more names that are unrecognizable here or not so familiar. There is a couple that, if you go back to the Old Testament, you'll recognize names like Zerubbabel here or Zadok. You know, they're referenced in Old Testament books, but they're not what we call major characters. Nevertheless, it just goes to show, again, the historicity of what Matthew is reporting, that these are real people that really lived. And what's probably most important as the genealogy is wrapped up here is what Matthew says about Joseph. He very carefully calls her or calls him the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. And so already you are getting this allusion to the fact that Jesus does not come in an ordinary way.
The only thing I was going to say is it's more fun to say it Zerubbabel, but that's fine.
That'd be fine with me.
Well, you know, this is what there is something kind of there is the two natures of Christ just kind of baked in here, because like you have all this the father of Joseph, and then he doesn't say then the father of Jesus, right? I mean, this whole thing is this person. This is all begats, right? Like this person begat this person begat this person begat this person begat this person. This is what it is. You go, you know, get some old you know King James language in there, and that's what you got. But he gets to Jesus, and then it's like, yeah, Joseph, the husband of Mary, from who came Jesus Christ, right? So there is Matthew. I don't know if people usually use this. I don't know, Scott. Maybe you could tell me in the apologetics world. I don't know if they use this as for the people that are like, hey, is Jesus really God? Well, Matthew in the first chapter definitely breaks right here and lets you know that Jesus is different.
Yeah, and the thing is, and one of the reasons the scriptures as a whole package are pretty great is because you have the genealogy of Joseph here, and then you have sort of a closer genealogy of Mary traced in Luke 3. And so the thing is, you put those together, no matter which way you're coming at this, you can see the genealogy of his adopted father, but then you can see Mary's too in the other one to go that direction. But here in Matthew, you really do, like you said, you get the emphasis on the two natures of Christ, because Joseph is listed here as the husband of Mary, and Mary is to the one to whom Jesus is born, and you'll get the miraculous account of how this is going to take place told just in a few verses here, that this is true God, true man.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a good way of summing all of it up. And so it says in verse 17, so all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. Now, the birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. And her husband Joseph, being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. Now, I've always found this little section quite admirable, maybe easy to ignore, but Joseph really does seem like a pretty stand-up dude, because I think the average dude out there, the average guy finding out that his fiance is pregnant, no matter how she says that she became pregnant, would be prone to maybe doing something even a little bit more aggressive than Joseph here. Joseph seems like, yeah, I don't want to do it. Okay, well, it looks like she may have cheated on me. I don't want to embarrass her. Like,
no, man, wow. It was the Holy Spirit. It was the Holy Spirit. Kind of fella. I swear it was the Holy Spirit. That'd be an awkward conversation that night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing that I think is like really fascinating about this is, one, you're right. Like, Joseph is a guy that doesn't get a lot of press because like he's not. We don't know what happened to him. Maybe he died, young. He doesn't show up after the very early chapters of the Gospels, right?
Yeah.
And but everything you do have about him, you're like, I don't know, man. Joseph seems like pretty good. And it says right here, right, that Joseph's a just man. And you kind of feel that where you're like, man, if it take a big person to sort of have this response. But what I think is fascinating is you might think that, but it says that he's a just man. And when like the Pharisees find like some adulterous woman in Luke, they think what it means to be a just man is to drag her in front of Jesus and say, all right, like, what are we going to do here? Like, there's a pile of rocks. Are we going to do the law? Are we not going to do the law? Are we going to do justice? Or are we not going to do justice? Are we going to be just men? Or are we going to be some rank antinomians here? What are we going to do about this situation? And so I do think it's fascinating that right here in like the first chapter of Matthew, you have the scriptures referring to Joseph as a just man based on his, again, and that Mary's telling the truth or whatever, but Joseph doesn't believe that yet. Like, that's not why he's just. You're not told he's a just man because he believed what Mary said. It says that he was a just man, and because he's a just man, he was going to extend what would look like grace to her and not put her to shame and not get her stoned or cast out or whatever. And what is Joseph, like, protecting her from? Like, in a lot of ways, he's protecting her from the punishment of the law, right? And you're like, mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Is that what it means to be just? And I think that maybe we sometimes, and certainly the Pharisees are this way, but even as Christians, I don't think we always know what God means when he says someone's a just person.
It's the Greek in here is dikaios, which is, you know, righteous, just, maybe even sometimes translated innocent, or godly. Mm-hmm. And I think all what you just said still applies, because every way you see that, the response could be from Joseph to apply the law, here. And the law would state that if she were caught in adultery, that she could be killed. She could be stoned. And their betrothal, I believe, in the culture was as good as their marriage. And so he had the right to do that. And that's why it says he mm-hmm. was going to divorce her. I think where the just comes, where we want to apply the law to just, but where it actually comes in with sort of righteous or God-fearing or something like that, is when he learns that really this is from the Holy Spirit. And he learns that, and he really does fall into line with that. Because a lot of this could be, the rest of it could kind of be explained by maybe he just loved her, you know. Not everybody who finds out their wife cheats on him wants to do her harm. Sometimes it's just, you're just broken because of your love, mm-hmm. but you don't want harm to come to her or to the child. But he finds out.
Part of it's God is like, there's like the, it's like being a just man, he's unwilling to put her to shame, right? And so why is he unwilling to put her to shame? It seems that the text is telling you because he's a just man.
Yeah, because he's
like, righteous. We sometimes think that, yeah, and we think sometimes like, well, if I'm going to be a righteous man, that means that I'm going to follow the letter,
yeah,
right?
Apply the law stringently.
But that's not the case, mm-hmm. right? Like that's in this sense, Joseph is a righteous guy, and because of that, he's like, I don't have to go and put this person to shame. Like, the law doesn't demand that I do it. It says I can do it, and that I'm not going to do it. It would seem that maybe a vindictive man mm-hmm. would. Maybe, you know what I mean? Like, so, like, there's something interesting about that. The reason it's interesting is because there in Jesus, like, adopted father, you see something Christ-like. Before the Christ, like while his wife is, or his betrothed is pregnant with the Christ, right? So why is Joseph a just man? Well, he's a little bit like Jesus from the jump, right? Because this sounds like something that Jesus would do, like, and in fact is something that Jesus will do, right? Where Jesus yeah. isn't going to go around and desire to put sinners to shame, even though Mary's innocent in this. But
yeah,
Joseph
Mary's done
that.
Nothing wrong. But, you know, Joseph that. Does reflect Jesus here, because it's like love and justice meet. In this person and in these actions, I can't help but think of Peter when he says, love covers over a multitude of sins. And there is something to that, you know, like we're going to absorb the wrongs done to us, and we're going to try to put the best construction on, you know, the people we come across, to use some of our catechism language. But and so this is kind of a beautiful picture. And yet, of course, it is important to keep in mind Mary is not actually guilty of doing anything wrong. It's just right. the natural man is prone to thinking she probably did.
We're about to find that out. Yeah. He's about to find that out.
Well, all right, man. We are mm-hmm. at 30 minutes, so we got to leave it there. Strange place to end. Joseph is not going to get his betrothed stoned or shamed. And pretty soon, he's going to find out that, oh, it's a good thing I didn't do that, because turns out telling the truth, and we're going to get to that in the next episode, but we'll have to wait until then. I'll see you guys next episode.
All right, sounds good.